Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The United States has been at war in Afghanistan for nearly 18 years. But Gold Star father Terry Burgess says people often forget in ways that can be painful. His son, Army Staff Sergeant Brian Burgess, was killed on March 29th, 2011.
Beth actually had a coworker ask her, you know, after we told him that Brian was killed, and I said, well, what was he doing over there? Like he was at war, and they don't know that we're still at war. And it's very difficult to talk to them about it because they get that glazed look in their eyes. They don't want to hear it.
Terry's son Brian was one of the more than 2,400 Americans who have died in the war in Afghanistan. C.J. Chivers has been following the war for years as an investigative reporter with the New York Times Magazine. He's also the author of The Fighters, Americans in Combat in Afghanistan and Iraq, which follows the lives of six service members.
So what I'm describing is people who showed up in good faith, who with time came to understand that perhaps their labor was squandered by our government, by our senior officer class, and by our politicians.
But Chivers says we don't talk all that much about the longest war in U.S. history.
I think there's a lot of reasons. Part of it's the duration itself, and another part is that, you know, without a draft and living in the era of the all-volunteer force, a very small portion of self-selecting people go and serve, and the larger population tunes out the war. They don't have to worry about having to participate in it, and I'd argue that the thing you don't worry about pretty quickly becomes the thing that you don't think about. And so the wars have just dropped off the public radar.
And I wonder how much of that has to do with the fact that we don't see it. I think about boomers who grew up in the era of Vietnam who said that they had to deal with this in the news every day. How much of this is because we're not seeing every day the images of war?
Well, there's been periods where we did see a lot of the war. I mean, the wars have gone on so long. I mean, let's talk about Iraq and Afghanistan, that there were some periods where there was an awful lot of coverage. And I wasn't convinced in real time that a lot of people paid attention to it then either. But certainly the fact that it's not on the front pages and at the top of the hour in the various ways people consume their journalism, that certainly has a factor in it not being a central part of the national discourse as it should be.
How many U.S. troops are currently in Afghanistan, and what does our presence there look like right now?
Well, our presence there is small. It's about a tenth of what it was at peak, a little bit more than that. And there's a lot of ways to count who's there because there are some people who serve in or in the skies above Afghanistan but actually aren't posted there. We've been over 10,000 this year for much of the year. That's a pretty small footprint compared to, you know, if we go back and look 6, 7, 8 years ago during the Obama surge, as it was called, you know, the first term of the Obama administration, we went up to 100,000 of our troops on the ground.
Where is the American public today in regards to this war, other than the fact that many people, I think, have forgotten about it? Are we tired?
Well, I think we've retired long ago. I think the American public feels probably like you do and like I know I do, which is that these wars seem not resolvable, that the various reasons that we went to war and the reasons that were given and the doctrines that were presented across time, the promises or pledges of what we could expect from the wars just did not play out on the ground. And I think that's another reason people pay less attention to it, is a sense of frustration that we will achieve what the organizers of the wars say we're there to achieve. Then I think most people know quite clearly that that didn't happen and that there's not a great deal of faith in the wars themselves. There certainly is faith in the military. The public polling shows that across time. But I think skepticism for the wars themselves is very high as well.
And while we don't hear a lot, at least in the everyday conversation, about these wars, we do hear a lot in the news about ISIS. There's a lot of focus on ISIS and defeating them, but there's very little talk about the Taliban, for example. Why is that? I mean, the United States is in the process of negotiating with the Taliban right now.
Part of it is that the Taliban has not exported terrorism the way that ISIS has. ISIS has brought terrorism to many countries with spectacular acts of violence that have, you know, driven deep coverage. And ISIS has also served in some ways journalistically as a cartoon, you know, a click engine. ISIS is so extreme in its violence and its behaviors and has managed its media coverage so effectively through, you know, the so-called secret telegram channels, which serves as essentially a peep show for journalists, that ISIS has pushed its narrative and presented itself to the world with an unbelievable savvy that the Taliban has not. So ISIS, I think, understandably, captures a lot more public attention.
I do want to ask you about the escalation in tensions with Iran. Earlier this month, the State Department ordered a partial evacuation of the U.S. embassy in Iraq because of a supposed threat by Iran. You've covered this region for years. Does this signal anything to you?
I mean, it signals to me something that I'm concerned about. And let me explain myself. I mean, my role across most of these years has been to cover the human experience of war, the human experience of combat, from the bottom, from the lower ranks, and from the civilians who live where the violence plays out. And one clear takeaway from that, and from history as well, if anyone looks closely at war, would come reasonably to the same conclusion that I'm about to present to you, which is that war should be your last resort, not your reflex, not high on your list. It should be your last resort. Wars don't go as their organizers anticipate them, and wars bring incredible human suffering and excessive violence upon people, including innocents. And as someone who's covered the bottom and seen the cost of these wars across a wide demography, you know, our veterans and the people who live where the wars have been fought, I would just say that if we're contemplating military action against Iran, that I would hope that it is the last option, the last resort, and not something we're doing because we feel like it, not something we would do because it might play well with certain audiences, and not something we do because it's a reflex. I mean, I do sense hesitation among my friends who are still serving, and I would certainly expect that after, as you said earlier, in this, you know, 18 years of war, that there would be some bedrock skepticism among the larger population in the United States.
Let's pivot for a second to talk about your book. This is one day after Memorial Day, and in your book, The Fighters, you follow the lives of servicemen from 2001 to today. I'm wondering if there were any stories that stood out to you, particularly around this theme of Memorial Day when you were reporting.
I wrote the book and organized my life in many ways across these years around a pretty simple idea that combatants are human and they should be understood as human beings. And related to that was that the conversation that we have about war in this country, both officially and in the national popular discourse, has far too much general and not enough sergeant. This book aim was to cover the sergeants and the people near sergeants, you know, the lance corporals and the warrant officers and the captains and the privates first class, the people who actually fought and experienced the wars firsthand. And that was what I set out to do, you know, on each of my reporting trips over the years. And around about 2011 or 12, when I realized I was going to try to make this cohere into a book, that's what I tried to capture in this larger narrative called The Fighters. And there are many stories that stand out. They have a common theme often. As the wars followed their arc, as, you know, year two became year 10 or year 12, there was a real evolution in this experience. And part of the evolution was, of course, that the enemies changed, the equipment changed, the doctrine changed, the reasons we were fighting changed. But another part of it was emotional and psychological. I mean, there came a point at which the people who were fighting these wars struggled to connect what they were doing on the ground or in the air over these countries to the national security of the United States. In other words, it became hard to draw a clear line for what am I doing from this outpost that makes people safer in my hometown. as opposed to, am I here to survive my tour with my friends and leave as solid a personal account of myself as I can? In other words, the war will be the canvas upon which my character or part of my reputation for life might be written. So what I'm describing is people who showed up in good faith, who with time came to understand that perhaps their labor was squandered by our government, by our senior officer class, and by our politicians. And that became an arc in this book, although individually the experiences were far more intimate than that. So the book covers people who were ambushed or who ambushed other combatants, who were struck by IEDs, who lost friends, who were wounded themselves. And then it follows these people home, and you see what it was like to try to reintegrate into the rest of their lives, whether it was a civilian life or something like the peacetime military career that you might experience stateside. And the book follows these six characters through this arc, and it becomes very, very difficult. And I'd also add that the book is purposefully, unrelentingly vivid, and that means, you know, without a euphemism, grim. War is violence. War is, in many ways, an assemblage of state-sanctioned or socially sanctioned crimes. And, I mean, you're doing things that in any other context would be criminal acts, but you're doing them with the sanction of your society. That doesn't necessarily make it easier for the people who are doing it. And the violence goes in two directions. And so in this book, there is an extraordinary amount of finely detailed violence. Some readers will struggle with that. I didn't think it was my job to bring an airbrush to what our veterans often experienced.
So, Chris, you brought an excerpt for your book. We'd love to hear it. Do you want to set up the scene for us?
So this passage comes from near the end of the book in the year 2010 in the Afghan poppy production zone, a set of hamlets or villages that were collectively known as Marja. And the Marines had landed by helicopter and taken a portion of this zone and were pinned down for a few days, but waiting for other Marines to show up over land. And at one point, one morning about a week in, they left their initial positions and tried to assault through where the Taliban had been dug in and fighting them. And this was after they had suffered, the Marines had suffered some casualties. And what I'm going to read described one rifle squad at dawn leaving a protected position and crossing a field where they expected to be killed to go into what were basically were the other side's trenches. After they get there, they see their enemy's positions. Along the walls facing Building 316, Charforis's Marines found murder holes littered with spent brass from the gunfights of the preceding days. Inside the buildings and compounds, they discovered that Taliban fighters had hacked man-sized mouse holes through interior and rear walls, or had placed ladders and planks that allowed them to change position quickly. Unprompted, the Marines of 3rd Squad started ransacking rooms. They smashed furniture, shattered teacups, heaved bedding, broke doors. Nothing was spared. An Afghan fighter picked up a Quran from the door and complained in halting English. "No good," he said. "No good." Charforis realized that that was a step too far. He apologized. His Marines could read neither Arabic nor any of Afghanistan's principal languages. They had not recognized the holy text. He had an idea. The Afghan soldiers seemed disgusted at the Taliban, too. He asked the interpreter to tell the Afghan soldiers they could help. "From now on, you guys grab the Qurans," Charforis said, "and then we'll trash the place." The Afghan soldiers agreed. The squad continued to tear through the deserted hamlet, kicking in doors. Charforis's Marines were fit, armed men rushing through someone else's maze, marking their path with a trail of broken goods. After days of being stuck under fire in a single building, they felt released. Half hunting, half raging, they were gripped by a hunger and a power that the architects of the Pentagon's counterinsurgency doctrine rarely acknowledged. One of their friends had been killed. Now they moved with a contempt that was timeless, exhilarating, satisfying, and channeled by youth, a living exhibit of why Americans' soft-touch notions of counterinsurgency pursued by conventional troops who had enlisted to fight, would almost never work. Circumstances for 3rd Squad had aligned. Officer catechisms had faded. They were not here to make friends. They were here to find the men who had been fighting them and kill them.
C.J. Chivers is a long-form writer and investigative reporter with the New York Times Magazine and the author of The Fighters, Americans in Combat in Afghanistan and Iraq. Chris, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.